MechCast, Friday, March 30th, 2012. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Hey, I got a cool episode for you today. If you've been listening to the MacCast for a while, you know that occasionally I'll have Ara Derderian on from the HD TV podcast at htguys.com, and we talk about Mac Mania as a home theater, and Ara's been evolving his system as Apple's technology has changed. I think last time we spoke, we talked about his conversion to an all-Apple TV 2-based system on the TV side. And if you want to hear those episodes, you can go back. You can find them. Just look for Mac Media Center episodes. There's a category up at maccast.com, and you can check them all out. But Apple made their announcement of the new iPad, and when they did that, they also announced a new Apple TV. And the new Apple TV has support for 1080p. So everything that Ara has built and we've discussed on those prior episodes was all focused around the 720p technology, and that was what Apple was delivering with iTunes, and it was all Apple solution. And 1080p was one of those things that video files really want Apple to support, and they hadn't really supported yet. And now with the new Apple TV, they are supporting 1080p and upgrading the iTunes content, but that still leaves a lot of us who have systems and have technology, Mac Minis specifically, where maybe we've built a system that's not optimized for 1080p. And after one of the episodes that I had done recently, a guy named Dean Dowger sent me an email. He's a MacCast listener. He's also a Mac developer. He's been in the community really focused on high-end scientific applications and software, and more specifically, cluster computing, eking a lot of power out of multiple nodes of Macintoshes to do really high-end processing, be it, you know, mathematical algorithms or video processing, encoding, and stuff like that. And so he has his own kind of home project where he had built an entire system focused on delivering 1080p content to his television using Mac Minis and Apple technology. And it was a pretty amazing setup. And so he emailed me, kind of pointed me to his webpage and said, hey, I've been doing this. This is how I've been doing 1080p. And I thought it would be great to get him on the show. So a couple weeks ago, I went out, I had him on the show, and we distributed that to MacCast members. But I wanted this content to reach the broadest range of people possible. So I'm delivering it to you, MacCast members, as part of their membership. They get exclusive early access to some content, and this was one of those shows. So I'm going to share it with you today. I hope you find it interesting and informative. But before we get to that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that's Circus Ponies. They make a product called Notebook. I've told you about it in the past, but it is really one of those applications. If you don't own it or you haven't tried it out, I would head over to their website, download a free trial. You can check it out. But, you know, it sounds, when you hear the word notebook, you think it's a note-taking application. And that was the first time I purchased it, that was why I got it, to take notes and kind of keep some thoughts and ideas and stuff organized. But as I started using it, I started to realize that it could do a lot more. The functionality in there is just really broad in terms of the applications. And I think I got hung up on the note part of it, the note-taking part of it, but it's the book part of Notebook that really makes this application shine, because you can drop in audio files, video files, PDF files. You can add in all kinds of clippings from the web, and it'll give you link backs to those clippings. You can do research in it. You can annotate stuff. You can add in sticky notes and flags, and you can have multiple sections and pages, and all of that stuff then gets indexed in multiple ways, so that when you have to go back and find specific bits of information, the technology they use is called the Multidex. It's exclusive to Notebook. And it just makes finding your stuff very easy, keeping it organized, keeping it all together. And what you'll find is you can kind of make notebooks for different things that you're working on. So in my case, I have some for my podcasts, or when I'm planning a trip, I might throw my research in there, put clippings for places that I think I might want to stay or places I want to visit. And I can put in photos to kind of remind me of where that place is. If I'm, you know, at a event and I need to take some notes, I'll turn on the audio recorder and you can record the audio just in case you miss something in that, come back and review that later. So the functionality just goes really deep and the metaphor makes a whole lot of sense once you start using the product. So I think the best thing you can do if you haven't checked it out is go to the website, download the demo, try it out. Circusponies.com is the place, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. And a big thank you to Circus Ponies for their support of the MacCast. Now, before we get into the interview on the home theater setup, I do have one item that I want to follow up on from the last episode. And I had talked about batteries. Somebody had asked about, you know, how do you get the best life out of your battery? What is the best way to keep your batteries in good condition on your iOS devices, on your notebooks and laptops and things like that? And so I came out and said that the premise that I understand now with modern batteries, modern lithium ion batteries, is that the key is to keep the electrons moving. And a couple people wrote me to point specifically to something that Steve Gibson from Security Now said about batteries on a recent Twit episode, I believe, or he has a show on the Twit network. I think it was actually his show on the Twit network. But many of you felt that what I was saying was in contradiction to what Steve was saying. Steve had said something to the effect that you should charge your batteries whenever you can. And more specifically, I went back and looked at the transcript. The exact quote was, he said, "It's actually better for the chemistry not to be running it all the way down. So there's logic in charging often." And I wanted to clear up some confusion because I'm in 100% agreement with what Steve was saying. I think the problem when we start talking about batteries and conditioning batteries or keeping, and I don't see this, that it's that conditioning batteries that's the problem, because you really don't need to quote unquote condition or deal with memory issues with modern batteries. What you need to do, though, is you need to use modern batteries. You need to do, Apple calls it charging cycles, and there's all this terminology around it. But the point is that you don't need to do this deep cycling that we used to do where you run it all the way down to zero. That's actually probably a bad thing for modern batteries, and then pump it all the way back up to 100%. We don't do that anymore. The thing that we need to do is cycle it. As I said, keep the electrons moving, keep the battery moving. The only bad thing that I've noticed is you do not always want to keep your notebook plugged in. And I don't think Steve was saying that. He was saying, when you see the battery running down and you have access to a power port, go ahead and plug it in. That, we're talking about you're down 20%, 30%, 40%. Plug that back in and let it charge back up to 100. That's good for it. That gets the juices flowing and the electrons moving. But you don't want to leave your device plugged in 24/7, 365, and keeping it charged at 100%. You also don't want to run it all the way down to zero and then store it away and leave it with no charge in it forever. Modern batteries like to be bounced between a low charge and a full charge. So you can go back and forth and do that. And that's probably the best way to use your batteries. And all of this ultimately results in the life of the battery, how long the battery is going to last and continue to be able to be charged and recharged and things like that. Cycling it is good for the battery. I have destroyed batteries in my laptops because I use them as desktops and I leave them plugged in 100% of the time. And by destroyed, what that means is that I've had to replace batteries after two and a half years. Whereas if I had kept the electrons flowing, I could probably get more like 3 or 4 years of life out of a battery. So that's just the thing to be aware of. Don't keep it all the way charged all the time. Don't let it be stored at a zero charge. It's part of the reason why Apple and a lot of companies that ship products with lithium-ion batteries ship them with about a 75% charge in them. That's the best way. If you know you're going to be putting a device away for a while, that's how you want to store it. And yes, for sure, use the battery. Let it run down. Undock it from the charging cable for a while. Let it run down. And when you see it getting at 20%, 30%, 40%, then feel free to charge it back up if you have access to that power port. So I think we're all saying the same thing. The other thing that's a factor in the life of your batteries, keeping your batteries healthy, is temperature. You want to keep it in an environment that's under 95 degrees Fahrenheit or 35 degrees centigrade. And also, you don't want to have your device or your laptop in a case, especially one of these padded sleeves, when you're charging it. You know, take it out, let it have airflow around it as you're charging it so it doesn't overheat. Heat will really kill the life of a battery. And again, when we're talking about battery life, it's important to remember that it just has to do with how much of a maximum charge it'll ultimately hold. As the battery ages, it starts to hold less and less of a charge, which means you'll get less battery life out of it. And that's just a natural thing. And lithium ion batteries, as far as I know, everything that I've read, really don't last much longer than 3 or 4 years. And you're going to have to plan on replacing batteries at some point. You know, they're going to use up their useful life. It's just one of those things. So Apple has a great page on their website with a bunch of technical great info and recommendation on batteries. It's apple.com/batteries. And then they have specific sections for each one of the different devices. So if you want to read more about this and sort of Apple's philosophy on it, and that's where I get a lot of my information from, you can go check that out. And I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But I just wanted to follow up on that because I know there's a lot of confusion around this topic. So let's get into some Mac Mini Home Theater. Here was my conversation with Ara Derderian and Dean Dowager. So hey, Ara, welcome back to the MacCast. Good to have you back again.
Always a pleasure to be on with you, Adam.
And this is a little bit of a different episode because you and I have done these Mac Home Theater episodes in the past. And the last time we talked about the fact that you had moved your setup, which was all Mac Mini-based, to an Apple TV-based system. And after that episode came out, I received an email from Dean. Hey, Dean, how you doing?
Hi. Hi, Adam. Hi, Ara. thanks for having me on here. This is great.
Yeah, and Dean is a MacCast listener and yes. Also has been in the Mac community for a while, right? You have a company.
That's right.
Then you write software that's been focused mainly on, like, what do they call it these days? You know, grid computing, distributed computing, what?
Well, the name I give would be cluster computing. So that we do the kind of parallel computing that's compatible with what the supercomputers do. Is that the same kind of computing there where there's lots of interaction between different nodes, different parts of the hardware. And that's sort of my sort of claim to fame, if you will, was that I was one of the two inventors of the Macintosh cluster. That is a cluster that was built using Mac hardware and the Mac OS. Before that, it was just Linux and Beowulf clusters. And I remember, and that was back in 98, and I remember, I'm laughing in retrospect, is that I remember we were on Slash, you know, we were like pointed out on Slashdot, and like some posters were saying that, how can you compare a Cray flop, floating point operation, to a Mac flop? It's like they thought that they couldn't be the same thing. It's like, so I think we've did our part to be able to help the reputation of the Mac, and certainly in the scientific community. And working out from there,
right?
So that's the so that's been the thrust of my little company. And it's sort of like a 1.5-man show. Go ahead.
Dowager Research is the name of the company.
Dowager Research.
Dowager. I knew I was going to get the pronunciation.
That's all right. No one gets it right the first time. I think that's fine. Myself and my dad and all we've been kind of doing that for years, so that's fine.
Dowager Research and you had, I think, sent me a while back, and I can't even remember if we talked about it on the MacCast years ago, but you had a software called Pooch, right?
That's
the name of the software, and that would allow you to do all kinds of distributed things, but obviously one of those applications would be video encoding, right? Because we can cluster multiple Macs together and kind of get video encoding done faster. So I'm curious now, so what leading into all this, why we're covering all this background, is you had sent me an email after that episode and said, hey, I have a home theater setup based on Mac Minis, but I am fully focused on really high-end 1080p.
Yeah.
And you pointed me to a great post on your website, and I'll put it in the link in the show notes for people to check it out. But what we're going to cover today is sort of how you put together your Mac media setup. And how it's focused on 1080p, right?
Yeah, that's right. Is that I listen faithfully to the Mac. Like, my wife and I have been listening since 2005 to the Mac. It's great work that you do, Adam. We love it.
Thank you.
And so it's wonderful to have that, and how you support the community. So it's like, and then when I listen to these, when you were talking with Ara on these home theaters, like, oh boy, they're going to talk about, oh, what else do other people do with right. the Mac? And then, but then it's like that last one that was like right before Christmas, there's like, I listened to that like, oh, well, you know, maybe there's something I could add here. Because it's like there wasn't enough, I thought, discussion about 1080p, in my personal opinion. But that's just me.
Well, I think Apple agrees with you because, right, they just came, the announcement this week was they upgraded the Apple TV. Part of the reason when Ara and I were talking, right, Ara, was that the Apple TV and everything Apple was doing didn't support. I mean, Apple wasn't putting out 1080p content. They didn't have 1080p playback on anything. So I think one of the points in that episode was it was kind of a moot point to try and target 1080p if you were looking at just doing stuff the Apple way, right? This is separate from your own ripped content at that point, because there was no way to get 1080p on a television set using Apple gear.
Exactly. And in fact, before the announcement, Apple had made a comment about how, oh, okay, 1080p... you're not going to see the difference. And for most cases, that's a true statement. Now, when you start getting into bigger screens, then, of course, you will see the difference. And I'm interested to hear what Apple's take is going to be on how they're going to back away from that original statement. because now, all of a sudden, oh, we're embracing 1080p.
Right. Yeah. And to clarify what I was saying, and to lead into Dean's email back was, well, you know, 1080p is possible, not with Apple TV technology, but using this other setup that I think we're going to get into and talk about. And then obviously Apple now with the new Apple TV is supporting 1080p. So we're moving in that direction. So I think this is great timing to kind of have this conversation and show you how you can roll it now without, you know, with the kind of setup you've got going, Dean, and I'm sure people can tweak it in different ways depending upon their needs. But we'll just get into all the little bits and pieces and components and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there's, if I may, what, just 15 more seconds or so, one other back part of my background is that I, in a previous part of my career, back in 93, 94, worked on a set of tools called Kai's Power Tools.
Oh, cool.
Back then.
Yeah, that was awesome stuff. Didn't know you worked on that.
Yeah, so I was one of the two programmers. They pulled us out of college to do this, just like they work on a summer, you know, skip a semester of college to be able to work on that. And that's when we did that. It was just myself and another friend from Harvey Mudd College way back when. And so it's like that's how I have a background also in graphics as well as this clustering and other, you know, network bandwidth and things like that. So it's like because I learned from Kai Krause about like the importance, what's important in graphics, it's like I've been able to combine that together in how I look at building a home theater that's using that uses computers to be able to push the data there. So that sort of informs some of the decisions I made as well.
What prompted the decision? Because, you know, a lot of people would go, well, I can just buy a Blu-ray player and buy Blu-ray discs and hook them up to my big screen TV and I'm done, right?
Yeah. You can do that, but, you know, it's like I was getting impatient with my Blu-ray player. That's the first and foremost thing. It's like I have the LG Super Blue player that, you know, I was that does both HD DVD and Blu-ray because I want to be agnostic between the two. But it's just like when a Blu-ray loads, it's like it takes such a horrendously long time to boot up and then boot up the disc and then get through some preview and then some worrying about like your delays of 2 or 3 minutes because I didn't update the firmware, but I did update the firmware. It's just and then meanwhile my son is like who's about to turn 5, he's like, Daddy, why don't you get this thing going? Why don't you do this? He's all giving me a hard time. It's like, but then I sympathize with his impatience as well because I'm a little bit impatient about that. I want to just get to the movie. I don't want to get through like 5 different previews and then what's the online BD live and stuff.
See, I guess I've always bought into the bag of hurt thing because I've never upgraded to Blu-ray. Ara, is that kind of your thing too with Blu-ray? I know you do a lot of Blu-ray stuff.
Yeah, and you know the newer players like some of the Oppo players have reduced a lot of that time, Dean. Yeah. They boot up and they'll get to the movie much much faster. But there is no way to get around some of these ads, and that's my biggest annoyment. which is why I went into ripping it. I mean, other than the fact that you don't have to have 300 discs laying around, I've got a library of about 298 movies, and you could just dial it up whenever you want. So there's that convenience factor as well. And like Dean was saying, you hit play, movie starts.
So, okay, wait. So now I have a question for both of you, because going back to Apple announcing this week that Apple TV is now going to support 1080p, there has been this long debate about, you know, Blu-ray took so long to kind of standardize things, and obviously the technology has taken a few years to kind of improve and get to a better user experience. And I think Apple's argument has always been, well, you know, discs and Blu-ray, that's, you know, that bag of hurt thing. It's impossible. We're going to have iTunes and we're going to be able to deliver it this way. And I know we've talked about this before, Ara, but I mean, do you guys see, is the future going to be just direct digital for 1080p content, or are we still way too far away from that? Because there's still that whole compression thing that nobody likes to talk about, well, right? Everybody wants to talk pixels and, oh, 1080, this is 1080p, but not all 1080p is created equal, right?
Yeah, yeah, a couple things you said there. One, you said future. How far out in the future? I do believe eventually the future will be downloads, but you know, not tomorrow or even next year. Blu-ray discs are going to be around for quite some time because they still are going to have the highest quality content that you can get. Now, Apple, with this 1080p, has improved their compression algorithm. I don't know if that's one of the main things the new Apple TV, is that it has a better processor so it can deal with the compression. So they're getting better picture quality with less bits coming across. But it's still, in my mind, it's not going to be as good as Blu-ray, but it's definitely 100 times better than DVD.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's just, oh, absolutely. The way I approach this system is like I'm thinking like a cluster designer. And so there's one of the important things to think about is not just crunching CPU, but also bandwidth, and how, you know, where are the bottlenecks in terms of getting data from one spot to the other? And these compression algorithms I see as yet another bottleneck that's here, and because they have to fit within, you know, they have to fit within whatever speed that the Apple servers can do in North Carolina or something like that, bringing data over the network and not oversaturate, you know, Time Warner, Roadrunner, or whatever ISP that you're using. So they have to have these compromises there in terms of fitting within certain pipes. Mm-hmm. But if you want to, to me, at least today, if a consumer wants to get the highest quality movie content that they can get, it's 1080p on Blu-ray. I mean, who cares that? And so the way to look at it is that who cares that it comes on a piece of plastic? It's just like you're trying to get the best quality movies that you can, regardless of what it is. And so once that arrives at your house, then what do you do with that data from that point is a different question.
But I want to tag on to that if I could. While that is 100% true for the vast majority of people, they're not going to see the difference. I've done tests at the house. I have a 100-inch screen here, and I've had like 10 people in the theater, and I would do an A/B between 1080p, 720p, and DVD. For the most part, everyone could tell a difference between high def and DVD, although there's some who couldn't even tell that difference. When you got into 720p to 1080p, a lot of people, even on a big screen, had a big issue. So I think Apple understands that, and they're saying, well, yeah, there's going to be those purists that just, they're going to get Blu-ray. And then there's going to be most of the other people who are going to find our 1080p to be completely acceptable.
Right. So we're talking about, I mean, in this conversation, we're talking about Apple's typical consumer, right? Who is the person who just wants ease of use, is probably your average person. But I think in the discussion for today, where we're getting to, and I want to come back to you, Dean, to talk about the requirements when you started building up your home theater is, okay, what happens if you want to take it to the next level? You want to say, I want to try and achieve a Blu-ray quality in a digital system. We're not going to get that from Apple, it sounds like, and that's not going to happen anytime soon because of bandwidth issues, because of other technology issues, whatever those might be. It could even be some of the studios saying, well, that's just too high quality and we're worried about piracy. So let's move into, so we got all the background here. Let's get into your setup, and let's maybe just start with what were your requirements when you were sitting down and going, okay, I want to build something. What are we building up to?
So, like, my first test was that I have a couple portable high-def camcorders, and my first sort of inkling of how to look at this was like, okay, what if, you know, I want to edit my video in iMovie or at the time, you know, Final Cut Express, and now today Final Cut Pro X. Mm-hmm. And so it's like I have some 1080p or 1080p content that I made myself. How do I view this on my 1080p screen, my 65-inch plasma display that I bought? I don't want to go through a piece of plastic because it's like I don't want to go bother burning it and back and forth. It's on the hard drive. How do I get it on there?
Right.
And so it was like I first got my 1080p plasma back in, what was it, December 06. And it's like, and I tried hooking up. I had my like the first gen MacBook Pro, and what I like my first tests were those 1080p trailers from the Apple website. That was the easy way to be able to test it, to be able to try to test 1080p content. And my MacBook Pro couldn't quite push it. I had to like pull out like a Mac. A year later, my Mac Pro could do it, but that's just too big to mm-hmm. put in a home theater.
and so loud, I had to probably.
Yeah, exactly, and loud. So it's like I had to wait, and then it turns out I recommend AppleCare for any MacBook anyone gets, because in 2009 it broke down so badly Apple said, here's a new MacBook Pro, yay!
Right.
So that was 2009, and then in this one, which is the one I'm using right now, it did push 1080p to my high def. So like, oh boy, Apple has done it, and so in their portable hardware they can do it, and therefore the Mac Mini of that time, I guessed, would do it. And then so that's when I bought my first Mac Mini, was in mid 2009, and that one did. It's a 2.26 gigahertz dual core Intel. Got 2 gigs of RAM in it, and it did push that data. So that was my first sort of that. So that sort of satisfied that first inkling of like, okay, this is video I made. I could in theory put it on the Mini and then push it to my display. But then I thought, you know, I heard about these other home theater solutions about like taking Blu-ray content and pulling that and pulling it off the Blu-ray disc and putting it on a computer. Now, I have a friend who did it on Windows, like Windows Media Center, uh-huh. And he was able to do some things, but I didn't like how he did it exactly. That, you know, it came up with all these like Windows messages that you got to do this service pack update and all this other junk that Windows does. So it's like that doesn't quite look right. So let's see if we can do this right with the Mac. But on ripping Blu-ray on the Mac just wasn't sort of around, it seemed like, in 2009.
Right.
And I looked, and like in December, I use a software called PathTube, but don't use it. Don't use PathTube. But it taught me some things, was the thing. But I ultimately went to MakeMKV. But what PathTube did is that it was able to rip Mac Blu-ray, but it compressed it, and it retranscoded into whatever I wanted. There was an art to be able to redo that, and then I played it back my Mac Mini, and then all these compression artifacts. I can see all this banding and all this other stuff. It's like that's just not good enough. But then what MakeMKV does, which is really very clever, it's something that I emphasize when I talk to other people about this, is that it decodes the Blu-ray, but it doesn't transcode the data. It pretty much saves the data as it was on the Blu-ray, but without the encryption. And that's a very crucial thing, because just like on a photocopier, when you make a copy of a copy of a copy, same kind of thing happens when you compress and compress, is that you lose some detail in some way, or unless you're really clever about how you reconfigure handbrake and so forth. It's sort of an art form to do that, and it can be done if you know what you're doing. But it's just like, why not just save the data exactly the way it was on the Blu-ray? And why wouldn't that be better in terms of quality? But of course, the downside, as discussed by Ara in the last podcast, is that the file sizes are huge. You know, anywhere from 20 to up to 40, in some cases 40 gigabytes per movie. And so if you want to have a jukebox make a jukebox out of this thing, you like say a 1 terabyte hard drive is going to hold about 30 of these movies. So it's like, so we're talking about terabytes of data.
Right.
And
so let me ask you a question real quick about the whole MKV thing and the MakeMKV, because I don't think we've gotten into this too much. And this is the same software you use, Ara?
Yeah, for ripping the Blu-rays, that's exactly what I use.
Okay, and so MKV, is it fair to say that an MKV is very similar to what people might be familiar with if they have ever ripped a DVD and you end up with a video TS folder, file, whatever you want to call it?
No, it's a little bit different.
Okay, yeah. So how is it different? Because again, you're talking to a layperson, because I don't have a Blu-ray player, so I've never created an MKV file in my life.
Right. When you rip the DVDs, you get the VOB files, and so it'll be a folder, and then typically a DVD player just knows how to string all those things together and make sure that you have a seamless presentation. MKV is just one big file that has all the information.
Right. MKV is the way it was. The name comes from Matryoshka, as in the Matryoshka dolls of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
That it's a container format; it contains things in them. It's the open source analogy of actually QuickTime Move (MOV), because that's actually contain different codecs in there. So MKV can contain a video of any codec, and so Blu-ray comes in two different styles. It doesn't matter what they are; it's just that they do. But it can also hold the multi-track audio in whatever format, whether it be DTS HD, or if you want to dumb it down to just regular DTS or Dolby Digital, or down to stereo if you want. You can actually make MKV to do some of that conversion there. And then also include subtitles. So there was cases where I was watching, what was it, the first Avenger, Captain America, mm-hmm. and there are some parts that are in German. And so I was able to play back the MKV and see the German subtitles, the forced subtitles of Hugo Weaving talking in German and like seeing what he said through that movie. And so that's all preserved in the MKV. But the difference between that and the video TS is that it's MKV is its own format that reorganizes the data into that MKV format rather than preserve it as if it was a disk image of the standard FDVD.
Gotcha.
In the video TS case.
Okay, cool. So now we've got these huge files, right?
Yeah.
So how do we deal with this?
Yeah, so there's a couple different ways you could do this. I mean, the first and foremost, you got to get a big hard drive of some kind, just to be able to hold on to that data as many as you can fit. And I sort of cycled through it myself. And what at first I used like just a 1 terabyte LaCie hard drive that I bought years ago that I made available. But then I started getting hard drive issues with it. Just like I lost one MKV, but it's a movie that I had on Blu-ray, so it's like I could just re-rip it. But it's like, ooh, that's making me nervous. So I went to Drobo in this case. And so I actually had today I have two Drobos. So I have one Drobo that's dedicated that is for like storing my pictures and my documents, scanned documents, backups of stuff, timeshare, time machine backups, and so forth. And then the other Drobo has 4 1-terabyte drives that are dedicated just to MKV high def content. So that's 2.7 terabytes, excuse me, of protected storage of MKVs. And so that gives me, 90 movies or so in that case.
So is that your own, and that's directly connected to the Mac Mini through what, FireWire 800?
Well, that's the way you could do it.
Okay.
And so that's at the top of that page, that link that that listeners are definitely
to look at.
So the top of that page is like I took what I did and simplified it. Okay, what are the fundamental pieces here? And so in principle, this isn't what I've actually done, but.
We'll get to your exact setup.
Yeah,
but.
Exactly. But what you would do, a sensible thing to do is that you can plug in this Drobo with all this data on there directly into the FireWire 800 on the Mac Mini, and then use that and then have Plex look at that folder. You can tell Plex to like configure it to be able to look at the folder where all your MKVs are, and then display that on your. On your home theater system. Now, at the time, I got an 09 Mac Mini, and so it was late 09 that I found this thing that turned DVI plus USB, DVI for the video and USB for the multi-track audio, and turned into HDMI, so it'd be easy to plug into my Denon receiver. But today's Macs, after this. I think today's and maybe for the last couple of years, they've have HDMI out of these
on Mac Mini.
On Mac Mini. So that's just like it's like a no brainer.
What's the little USB adapter though? If somebody had an older Mac Mini, that's something you get from Monoprice.
Yeah, Monoprice was the place where I got it. I think there are a couple other equivalents out there you can find on Amazon, but that was like the first place that I saw it, and it wasn't available until like 5 months after I got my Mac Mini. It's like, oh boy, I don't have to use an optical plus a DVI. It's like pieces were coming together anyway back then.
So on the audio side of things, because I think we've talked a few times about using the optical Toslink kind of cable to get the audio into your home theater setup. But now is, and again, just because I don't know, so I'm going to ask the dumb question, and everybody's probably screaming, you should know this. I'm losing nerd cred here. But so HDMI can carry both your digital audio and your video all on one cable.
That's yeah, cool. And okay. Actually the good thing about HDMI is it'll carry next generation audio. The Toslink won't support that. So if you want Dolby True HD or DTS Master Audio, you need to use the HDMI.
That's right.
Cool. So this thing allowed you to take your USB pure digital audio and then your video and get that all through the one cable.
And to add to that, the Make MKB will preserve the Master Audio DTS as well as the True HD as well. Now, in my system, I happen to have an older Denon that doesn't support those newer ones. So for future-proofing my system, when I rip the True HD or Master DHS. But I tell Plex today just to look at the regular DTS for now. But, you know, that's one of the things I'll upgrade down the line. You know, home theaters are always an evolving thing anyway. So that's always fun. But, yeah, I definitely do the multi-track audio over the USB. And so if I were to recommend for someone now, if they were like if they're recently building a system or about to, then yeah, I would definitely recommend some kind of a wired solution like HDMI rather than using Toslink for the reasons that Ara just said.
Right, and so the Durobo completely replaced the LaCie. Both these things are just for storing the MKV files.
That's right. That's right. And I personally recommend FireWire rather than USB as well because I've seen USB be a little glitchy in terms of like causing hiccups and things like that. I mean, even my iPods kind of glitch over USB. But FireWire is kind of going away. But you know, I imagine in the future we can use the Lightning one,
Thunderbolt.
That's right. Yeah.
I just got in a Thunderbolt drive for review. Yeah. The new Elgato. And it's an SSD drive. So.
Yeah. Yeah,
like I'm excited to get to play with that.
That should be nice and fast that way.
Yeah, and it's been so slow getting the Thunderbolt, but I would imagine that's in the future with the newer Macs with the Thunderbolt, that's going to be your best option for this kind of thing because we're talking about a lot of bits here, right? Having to fly through.
Oh yeah,
which is why if you're starting out with the simplest setup, direct connecting all this stuff, Mac Mini. Hard drives connected to the Mac Mini connected directly to your set is going to give you the fastest throughput. But, I mean, most of us have, a house with multiple TVs and multiple places. And, that's what we've talked about with Ara. So I'm assuming where we're going here is we're going to get this thing networked, right? Somehow?
Yeah, that's right. So
but we're still dealing with a lot of bits. So how do we solve all this?
Yeah,
issues?
The typical sort of data rate that you see out of here is anywhere from like 4 to, I've seen up to 6 megabytes per second or 24 to around 40-ish megabits per second pushing data through. And so even I would consider 100 base T to be kind of a little tight for that because it's only another factor of 2 beyond, like G.I. Joe was, I clocked at about 40-something megabits per second. So another factor of 2 is almost 100 base T, 100 megabit there. So what I've done is that, like, in the crucial points of my network here, I made sure I had gigabit. I had gigabit anyway because it was in my office because I was doing clustering stuff anyway. But actually, since the time that I sent you that email, I've actually upgraded my whole house to gigabit. So I have gigabit, like I got a 24 gigabit switch for not too much.
Well, to be honest with you, if you're going to try to set this up now, I don't think you can find less than gigabit equipment. Yeah. So you're probably, if you have gigabit, you're going to be just fine even with the multiple streams of Blu-ray.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's right. The gigabit is more than enough for a few streams to be able to make this work. I definitely see that.
Yeah, and Ara, last time when we were covering your setup, I think we did talk about that you are all wired, right?
Yeah, I'm all wired. In fact, I have redundant. I have two lines going to each room because there are some technologies that I've been looking out in the future that use the Ethernet for everything, and you won't be able to do data on it as well. So I just in case I was going to employ one of those setups in the house, I decided to run two cables to every room.
And with the 720p, refresh my memory, could you get away with wireless at all
if you weren't doing it? With my scenario, you could even do it with 1080p because I've ripped a 1080p. The Apple TVs will play 1080p. It just down converts them to 720p. So to kind of future-proof myself, I've been ripping at 1080p. The data rates I'm talking about, you could have two wireless streams if you've got a 802.11n. And very soon, they're going to have 802.11ac, and I got a lot of high hopes for that. This should bring this type of functionality to everybody.
Now, Dean, is that your experience as well, or is it even worth trying what you're doing with a wireless network?
I wouldn't. for the kind of data rates that of, you know, on the order of 40 megabits per second, I mean, that's like the
that's almost a theoretical maximum.
Yeah. Yeah, 55 megabit is the theoretical maximum for N airport. So it's like, that's
not
a little
gonna happen.
That's not a headroom, I think, for Blu-ray
For N 55 megabit, I thought that N was in 200 megabit per second for N.
Well, last time I looked, I thought it was 55, but still,
isn't it? What you're talking about, Ara, when they do the special, you know, like pairing, like if I have Linksys on both ends, and then they,
well, yeah, definitely,
you'd they do have some to trickery.
You'd have to have N around. So the Airport Extreme allows you to have a, I think it was at a 5.4 gigahertz, 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi signal as well. And that would just only keep N devices on there. So then you don't have to have this problem of it dropping down to G speeds.
Right.
But I will say this, even if you do have the theoretical capability to get that through, the problem with video is if you get dropouts, if there's a hiccup, it's just going to kill you. Whereas if you're surfing the net, okay, so it resends a few packets, no big deal. But when you're watching video, that usually translates into a stutter, and that will really detract from your viewing.
So, I mean, like, I have neighbors with Wi-Fi on both sides of me, and I know my father-in-law is like, as soon as the microwave oven turns on, it disrupts his Wi-Fi network. So,
I get that when I'm watching Netflix streaming in my living room. Yeah. You know, someone turns on the microwave, and boom, it's and I have an older Apple TV, you know, first-gen Apple TV that I'm using in there, so it makes sense as to why it happens. But I think what we're coming to is the same thing we concluded in that last episode, I think, Ara, is like, if you really want to do this and you really want to be pushing the highest quality, you know, you're going to want to do wired gigabit Ethernet, and then you're almost guaranteed not to have, well, shouldn't say guaranteed, but you're
the ball could be somewhere else. Yeah,
greater chance of not having issues.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
If you're trying to stream this now, what I do is that I do take my I do have one drobo that has all the high def material, but then the other Dribble has the standard, you know, less than high def, the standard def stuff, or like iPad compatible stuff. Mm-hmm. So what I do is that I on a regular basis, like from the movies I'm really interested in, I make iPad versions or iPhone versions of them, and I have a separate folder system for that on the other Dribble. The first and foremost what that's useful for is just to be able to take it on the road.
Right.
So like I need to entertain my kids with Cars 2 or something, or you know, Wall-E or the other Pixar movies or whatever. So I can load it on my son's iPhone. Well, it's because it's the hand-me-down iPhone for my wife and so forth.
Yeah, yeah.
And the iPad, yeah. Because we bought every model in our family. So that's useful for that. But where I'm going to store them? Well, store them on the Dribble. But why not stream those too? So there's a couple. There's a sort of a poor man's way.
Before we talked about the network stuff. So out of curiosity, what are you? How are you ripping those, or how are you converting those SD versions or the iOS versions?
Right. So the Handbrake is definitely the way to go on that. That Handbrake has an iPhone preset in there, but then
you're just taking the MKVs and then throwing them through Handbrake and then using the presets.
Yeah, that's correct. So that's, and it works really well and to be able to get the quality. It produces nice quality on the iPad. So that's like making a 1024x768 version. But there are a couple times that I've in a pinch, it's like when I've on my system I play back like the iPad version, this sort of 768-ish type version on my system, and I can see the difference between the MKV and the iPad version when I put it on my home theater. So it's like when I bring it down to iPad level, it isn't really good enough, I think, at that sort of 1024x768 level. Because I can see the difference there, in part because of the resolution, but in part because of the compression, because it brings it down to what's probably effectively 1 or 2 megabit or something like that.
You know, if you want a little bit higher quality, you could set it to Apple TV, and that will still play on the iPad. So if you want a little bit, but if you're watching it only on the iPad, it really doesn't matter. You want the file size, but if somebody's trying to, you know, do a compromise so they don't have to rip it a couple of times.
All right. Will that go all the way back to iPad 1?
I'm using the classic iPad myself. But with the Apple TV format, you said?
Yeah. Cool. All right. So now we're gonna get to the network stuff. So gigabit Ethernet, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
All right, and where is all your stuff stored now?
Okay, so the first time I tried this, I had used a Paramac G4867 to be able to do this, and I found that I'm looking for bottlenecks here, and I found that old G4 couldn't quite push that data through reliably. That it, even though it had a gigabit Ethernet port on it, it's just like it couldn't sustain this kind of video streaming at 30 to 40 megabit per second type of level. So I did have a couple old PowerMac G5s, and I think that if somebody else had them out, you know, somebody uses that, I think that would work. It so happens because of my connection to UCLA, I did this clustering stuff back at UCLA, and in 2005, our group had built a 512-node cluster of extra G5s at 2.0 and then later 2.3 gigahertz. And 5 years of funding from NSF ran out in 2010. And they said, well, we got to get rid of these things. And because of the nature of bureaucracy, it's cheaper to just make them disappear rather than actually dispose of them officially. so it was kind of interesting. So I kind of inherited a few extra G5s as a result.
This is my favorite part of your setup. So how many XServe G5s do you have?
So there, you know, I have four, and they even say it's like, take eight, go ahead, take eight. It's like, no, I don't have enough room, not enough weight. It's too much heavy for my car or something, because I got to drive from UCLA to where back here in Orange County. So it's a little too much to deal with to have eight of them. So I have four of them there, and I'm really just using one for the most part, and I'll use the others as spares.
Right.
And you know, it's like the Maytag repairman. It's like these things are so darn reliable. I mean, these things date from 2005, 2006, and they're still going strong. So it's like they're still really good. And you know, I'm running OS X Leopard server, so 10.58 on that case, because it's like that's the latest version that I can put on there. And so if somebody did this with a Paramount 2.5, you could probably just use clients and not use server.
Right.
But it so happens that I want to do Time Machine backup on the other Drobo, and then be able to upload other files and have custom SharePoints and fancy things like that, because I know how, I guess. So I have OS X Server, Leopard Server, on there. I have each Jarobo has its own FireWire 800 port, a dedicated FireWire 800 into the Xserve. But the way I have it physically set up is that the Xserves, the four Xserves, are in the garage, actually. And mm-hmm. it so happens that my office, my home office, has an adjoining wall to the garage. So I went down and I punched a hole mm-hmm. In the bottom there, so that the Xserves and a UPS that supports that is over in the garage, because the Xserves make noise mm-hmm. and they need ventilation. And I have like an HVAC filter on the front. In a rack, in the garage, so that you know dust in the garage doesn't affect the Xserves, hopefully. And then the power for the Jarobos, as well as the two FireWire 800 ports cables, which I have some 9-foot cables for that, go through the hole in the wall up into my Jarobos here. So the Jarobos are also on battery backup, just in case, you know, so that they can shut down properly and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So the data stream starts with the Jarobo, goes through the FireWire 800 into the Xserve, and then it goes out of the Ethernet there, which I have hooked up through the wall, which then goes into my gigabit switch that's in my home office. And it then also happens the opposite side of my office has an adjoining wall to my home theater. So that's kind of fortunate. The gigabit port goes from there in through the wall into the Mac Mini for my home theater. So literally, I've got like just one hop from the Xserve to the Mac Mini home theater.
Okay, and so the Xserves and the Jarobos, and this sounds similar to your setup, right? That's all that's about is storing the files and doing file serving.
Yeah, pushing the data out. Yeah.
So the point of that part of this whole setup is storage and file serving. So you really could use a lot of different solutions with Mac, different kinds of Mac hardware to solve that problem, right?
Yeah. That I mean, like my brother-in-law was inspired by my system. He uses an Intel Mac Pro to be able to do the same thing my Xserve does over here. And so he's using Lion in his case. So it's like, yeah, you can definitely substitute this. As long as it's fast enough, like G5 or faster mm-hmm. type speeds. And well, with a gigabit port.
I think a lot of people would be very happy to hear that, you know, G5 is fast enough for this portion of it, because so many of us have upgraded and we have, you know, that kind of hardware lying around or are getting ready to upgrade, especially now that Apple's really kind of moved completely away, you know, starting with Lion, from any kind of OS 10, you know, any PowerPC support whatsoever. So even the people that have been holding on to those great power G5 machines are starting to get upgrades. So here's something you can do where you can take that, turn it into a file server, and if you want to have that be the file server for your home theater setup, it's perfect for that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like, because I've got a couple of Paramount G5s. One of them kind of went out, but the other one is like going strong, and it's like, yeah, I'm definitely have like want to find a use for my other Paramount G5, but I have the Xserve, so I'm happen to be lucky. But other people, yeah, definitely could use that scenario.
Well, and then on the other side, I mean, you're using an older Mac Mini as well, and this is another thing that where you could probably anything that's an Intel dual core,
that's 2009 you know, era,
on 2 gigahertz or something like that or better, probably could serve as the thing. I'm assuming that's running your user interface, and we haven't even gotten into that yet. So I think that's the last piece, right? Have we missed anything along the way here?
Let's see. For the ingest and processing, for like taking the Blu-ray, and I happen to use a Mac Pro. One thing I would point out about ripping is that this is something I learned from another person who tried this was that it's, you know how we like the lean back experience and the lean forward experience mm-hmm. is that the process of ripping and decoding and so forth really should be, I think, is in that lean forward sort of scenario. So it's good to do at a desk, at a desktop or a laptop on a computer, rather than try to do it at your home theater. And it's something that if you can do that, if it makes sense for you, I'd recommend that kind of approach. For the ingest and processing type of thing.
So that's where you're running Make MKV like on
or Handbrake or handbrake to process it into what your iOS device compatible
and then
formats.
You just drop it onto your server to the Drobos.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, for that process, you're going to want as much power as you possibly have, because that's where the real number crunching happens.
where your time gets taken up.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, run that overnight, and where there's a lot of wind from your fans, so you don't want that messing up your home theater experience.
Right. How reliable is all that stuff? I guess that's a question I've never asked even you, Ara, is, you know, when you're running, how much do you have to babysit it? You know, because when these long processes go on, I like to, you know, have experiences where I can set it and forget it, you know, come back.
Well, like you can do that. The video I created that's available at our website that kind of walks you through the steps of ripping a Blu-ray, you typically the make MKV part doesn't take very long at all. That you could probably get done in about an hour. And so you'll put in your disc, you'll select which tracks you want, which subtitles, and you'll hit go and come back in about 45 minutes to an hour and you'll have your MKV file. Yeah. The part that really takes a long time is if you're going to transcode it the way I do to H.264. And there I'll queue up like three or four and say go and go to sleep or go to the office for the day and the computer just crunch away.
Yeah, I definitely find that experience as well. Is that was the neat thing, like the big contrast about using MakeMKV compared to like back when I used Handbrake on a standard FDVD is that because there's no transcoding, it only takes like 30% load on a single core of my Mac Pro, but I want to make an iPad version, well then it's using a whole like seven cores to be able to transcode that. So that's why it's like that's where the big difference is, and it's good to have I like to use my 8-core machine just because for that specific purpose of like I can transcode a whole bunch of MKVs into iPad versions or iPhone versions and queue all that up, let it run overnight or something like that.
Okay. On the Mac Mini side, on the playback side, we mentioned you have kind of two versions. You do. It sounds like rip an iTunes compatible version, and we have the MKV version. So do you put both those versions on the Mini, or are you only using those iOS versions on specific machines where you want to sync content to iOS devices?
I tend to keep that separate. That's the typical scenario, is that I do tell Plex on the Mac Mini to, well, actually, so let's back up.
I should mention that Plex is your interface. I guess what I was getting at is do you use iTunes at all on the TV side, or is it all something else?
Not really. Okay. I mean, very, very rarely. I mean, it's only like if I miss an episode of Fringe on my TiVo, it's like it didn't record. Oh my gosh! So then I go and download that, and then I quit out Plex, and I load up iTunes, and I go purchase that on the Mini, and just do it for that once. You know, just for this weird that to me that's the weird scenario in the way that we do things in this household is to play back something through iTunes on the Mini.
Okay, so the user interface, the 10-foot interface on your home theater running on the Mac Mini is Plex. And for anybody who doesn't know what that is, I can't remember how long it's been since we talked about it. I'm sure we've brought it up before, right, Ara?
Yeah, we've talked about Plex, Boxy. There's a whole bunch of
So what are all those Xbox Media stuff. What are all those things, Dean?
So these are media center software, and unfortunately Boxy has kind of discontinued their media center software for PCs and Macs. Boxy took itself out of the running. I like the UI a lot, so I'm afraid that one kind of went away. Plex is major, and Sage is another, and there's a few others.
XMBC,
that's right.
Has gotten pretty popular recently.
They're all kind of, most of them, including Plex, are kind of derivatives of XMBC. Like, that started on the Linux platform as an open source thing, and the people have made derivatives of that. And I find Plex, I prefer Plex out of all of them that are available today.
And why is that?
First and foremost, I wanted to make sure it played back well. that was reason number one. Because my standard reference was the movie Star Trek, the 2009 version of Star Trek. And there was like certain scenes in it that the Boxy at the time as well as Sage and a couple others, like it would jitter, the screen, the visuals would jitter, like when the Narada is firing these photon torpedoes at the Kelvin, it's like it would jerk. It's like, what? I don't want that. So Plex did it, and so that proved to me that the Mini could do it. It's just a matter of the software being optimized properly to be able to do it. So I sort of, and then I like the user interface of Plex, but it's a little bit Spartan. I liked the GUI of Boxy, but I kind of wish we had the best of both worlds, but unfortunately we don't. Mm-hmm. And so Plex has just been the workhorse for me in terms of my media center. Let's see.
And you're using an older version, you said, of Plex?
Yeah, I stuck with a 0.85 version of it, and it's just the way the version numbers are. And then for a while, like I saw, there's 0.92 had come out, and then it had that jitter in it, and I was like, I don't want that. So I sort of stuck with 0.85 for a long. In fact, I even stuck with Leopard. What was it? Yeah, that's right. I stuck with OS X Leopard on the Mini for a long time. Until Plex, I think it was 0.96 or something like that, that actually required Snow Leopard. So it was only like a couple months ago I upgraded Snow Leopard on my Mac Mini, and then I tried the new Plex. I thought, okay, it worked great. But I want to let it sort of settle for a while. So I'm still using the 0.85 version.
Right.
I mean, that's the other thing that I find about. Using a Mac Mini and home theater, that's a different way of thinking than we use on the desktop. In the desktop, we update regularly, update everything to the latest software, whether it be OS or the apps. But with the Mini, because we want the system to be totally reliable. It's like I happen to stick to an old version and just stay there that worked.
Right.
Rather than continuously upgrade.
We just had this conversation at my Mac user group because you know, if you've ever been in a Mac user group, you know, the membership is tends to be older, and they hold on to older hardware for a lot longer than maybe some of us who are really, you know, want to be at the cutting edge of all this stuff. But I think the argument can be made that, you know, when something works and it works well, yeah, as a nerd, you have this drive to always get the latest and greatest. But sometimes you have to step back from that. People step back from that, go, why? You know, what's broken about this experience that I'm having now that I'm trying to actually fix by upgrading? And a lot of times, if you're honest with yourself, the answer is I'm not gaining anything here.
Yeah, and I think, and for a Mac Mini and a home theater, I think you have to be more conservative than you otherwise would be about that, because when you get home from work, you want to be able to watch this movie, or my kid, like, he wants to see Kung Fu Panda 2. I want it to work. I don't want the glitch, because otherwise he's going to get upset at me.
That cycles us back to the beginning of this conversation about why not use a Blu-ray player, because the Blu-ray experience you're having, you know, it's prompting you to upgrade the firmware when you just want to watch a movie. And so you don't want to, you know, build this great setup that's working and then force that experience back on yourself where you're having to do, you know, IT troubleshooting when you just want to watch a show.
And another another usability thing I do with the Mac Mini is that, you know how you can make an administrative user and a standard user.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do is that I have an administrative user that's me as like username Dowger. Then I created a regular user called Family, and so I have it automatically, when it boots up, automatically log into the Family one, so I don't get the software updates. I don't get the software update reminders and all that. I have it boot up into Family. Set up an Apple script to mount the network drives from the Xserve, and then wait a few seconds, let Finder settle, and then go ahead and launch Plex. And so with just one boot, it just automatically goes into Plex smoothly without reminding me, like, oh, I have to do a software update or a security update or whatever. So, you know,
nice.
Yeah. So it makes it a nice, smooth experience when we're settling down on Friday night and like last night we watched Hugo and I just booted that up. It takes 30 seconds or something like that. But then I usually set it up to have it on the whole weekend and have it automatically shut down on the weekdays as well, so that just to save power, you know, save on the electric bill, because typically on the weekdays we don't really use it, but on the weekends we use it pretty intensely actually. And we've been doing this for the last 2 years, and about my son watches 1080p versions of all the kids' movies that have come out over the last couple of years or so. So we enjoy that quite a bit.
So any tricks in actually setting up Plex, or is it pretty much install and go, or, you know, how does that whole process work?
Install, go, I mean, you have to look up the documentation to get some of the things. I mean, like, to be able to set up the, to be able to tell it where the movies are, you have to, like, set up that folder or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. To be able to set that up. I do actually have it respond to the IR, infrared, on there, and I program my Denon, receiver remote to be able, I had it learn all the codes from the little Apple remote that was there. So I can use, so I am capable of using just one infrared remote, the Denon one, to be able to turn on the system and then direct Plex up and down, you know, up, down, left, right, and so forth, to be able to select the movie I want and go from there.
We talk about what are you using remote-wise? Well, I guess you're all on Apple TVs now, right? So you just use the regular Apple TV remote?
Yeah. Well, I actually have it built into my Harmony remote, so I've got the commands in there.
Oh, yeah. So you do a similar thing where you only have one remote.
Right. Yeah, and then also, like, well, if we have the iPad or the iPhone, that also works as well to control the Apple TVs.
Right, yeah. And the newest version of Plex allows that as well, to be able to control Plex using an iOS device.
Oh, that's kind of nice.
Now, you have to look this up in the documentation, but one of the neat things you do with the Plex is that you can have, like, you have to press the I key or the C key when you're looking at one of these movies, and it'll access IMDb to be able to get the thumbnail of it, as well as the synopsis info. So that when you're going through, you can actually sort of see the posters for each one of the movies as you go through. So that's kind of a nice thing you can do with Plex. There. So, you know, it's similar to what you can do on Apple TV if you buy it from Apple.
Right. But in this case, does it just download that on the fly after it kind of reads the MKV and goes, okay, I know what this is, and then sucks it down. And then, do you know, does it cache that so that once it's there, you have it from that point forward?
That's correct. So I haven't checked for sure, but I think it actually saves that the metadata on the Mac Mini. But because it thinks it's a local drive. As far as Plex is concerned, the network drive looks like a local drive anyway. So it just thinks it's there. So it just stores it within Plex that's there. And then, like, some extra things I've done is that there were apps in Plex that I was able to add Hulu and Netflix in there as well. So if there's something I want to stream from Netflix, I can do that through Plex and navigate through the user interface to be able to do that, working out that way. Let's see. That's a lot of it.
That's kind of it. Yeah. I think that covers everything. I was going to just ask you in closing if there were any kind of gotchas or anything that, you know, somebody would want to absolutely avoid or.
There was one thing. There's one little thing that happens because my setup is of the extra complexity. Like, are you doing Time Machine backups on it? Don't do a Time Machine backup at the same time as watching a movie.
I think that's good advice. You pretty much can't do anything while... you can. I mean, but I've noticed we do the same thing with podcasting. Like, when I'm recording like this, I make sure to turn off Time Machine. Yeah. Unfortunately, the bad thing is remembering to turn it back on. I've had some instances where it's like a week later and I go, oh, man, I haven't been running Time Machine for a week, which is, you know, knowing how I am about backups, that's a bad thing for me.
That's probably the biggest hiccup that I had was that, like my wife and I had our laptops open, and then we want to watch, you know, my kid want to watch a movie, or we want to watch a movie, and then it started jittery. It's like, what's going on? It's like, what's wrong? It's like, oh, we left the Time Machine backup on our laptop. So because it's going, because, like, Time Machine is a very different kind of thing than streaming video. It's that Time Machine is, like, bi-directional and sort of random, but video stream is one direction and steady.
Right.
So is my theory anyway as to why it is. So what we do in our laptops is that we actually just turn off the automatic backups and just, okay, after the movie's over, you know, you manually start the...
I got to remember. I need a script or something that, like, automates the process where, hey, I'm doing this now, go turn off my Time Machines. So I don't know.
But the other way that I did try was, like, I used, there's Time Machine Scheduler. There's a freeware thing out there that you can have it. And what I did at first was, like, schedule, like, only from midnight to 5 p.m., do it every 3 hours. You know, start the Time Machine back every 3 hours. But after 5 p.m., don't do it.
Right.
And so it's like if you just you can configure the Mac using this third party freeware to be able to get that going, make it not do time machine backups during the key prime time hours
when you're probably watching video content. Yeah.
Yeah. So you figure, at 18 or 12 hours a day of time machine backups is probably good enough. That's there.
So now let's talk a little bit about the future. I guess that's the last thing we can close out with. And Ara, I'd love you to chime in, especially now, because we do have the Apple TV announcement. And really the main difference on the new Apple TV, or the only difference as far as I know, is the 1080p support, and which is coupled with this new processor, which I think is a single core A5, Apple has said officially. So, Dean, I mean, is Apple TV a potential upgrade or something you might add into your system, or maybe add for an additional television to kind of tie into the system? Or I guess maybe not, because you're wholly reliant on the MKV, right? Which Apple TV is not going to play back.
Yeah, I'm a little wary of using it, at least for me, is that, first of all, of course, I've got everything in MKVs, and I'm looking at the tech specs for the new Apple TV, and it says M4V, MP4, and MOV format. So it can't play MKVs directly, so I'd have to transcode it. Right. But then I see some specs here about like high or main profile level 4. And so I'd have to test that, because I'm not sure what kind of bandwidth that allows. I don't think that allows the 40 megabit per second. I doubt that type of level, bandwidth level. And so I would kind of, my hunch is that it's going to get some compression artifacts out of that. And it's something that, at least on my system, I'm able to see. I mean, I'm able to see the differences between, the compression formats. I look at there's 720p and 1080i that comes over cable that I record in my TiVo. And it's like, I look at the 720 from cable, and it's like, I can see it's a little blurrier. I can see some compression artifacts. And it's just like, to me, sometimes just for fun, I record Planet Earth. And I have Planet Earth on Blu-ray as well. And I compare Planet Earth, which is on 1080i on Discovery Channel or whatever it is. There's one scene where there's like a huge flock of birds that rises out of a lake in Canada somewhere. And on the compressed version, I can see these blocky artifacts all over it. And then on Blu-ray, as well as through my home media, it's beautiful. It's crisp. I can see the individual wings of each one of these birds.
Yep, I know that video. I actually have that in my iTunes as a test video that I think I pulled down from somewhere. I pulled down the MKV and did the same thing. Threw it through Handbrake and made a 1080p version. I think I originally got it when I was trying to test. Somebody had asked me if the Apple TV would play 720p, which, as you mentioned already, it will, or 1080p, excuse me, downsampled through the Apple TV. But Ara, I'm assuming in your case, you said you're already transcoding 1080p in expectation that Apple would support it at some point. So
yeah, and the key thing here is Dean kept talking about compression artifacts. That is the issue more than the resolution. Actually, in reality, resolution is like the third most important specification in a system beyond the way it deals with color and contrast. So if you have a 720p system the way I do, and you do compress it less, so you'll get bigger files, because the Apple files, you can get 1 or 2 gigabytes. Mine end up being about 5 or 6 gigabytes, even at 720p. So I'd be more concerned about the compression. Now, if I can do that with 1080p, my file sizes will get bigger, because I'll be doing 1080p with less compression. It won't be up at the 30 gigabytes, but it'll probably get up to like 6 or 7 gigabytes, and that becomes hard to tell the difference between Blu-ray and what we're what I'm dealing with to, I'd say, 99% of the people out there.
Sounds like we have some testing to do on these new systems, right?
I've
done these tests for my podcast. I've done these tests with I've had people who are self-professed experts and the novice. The area, the biggest flaw right now, and Apple will be able to address this, I hope, soon, is the audio. Dolby Digital or DTS Digital is not the same as Dolby True HD or DTS True HD. You can definitely hear the difference, even. Yeah. the layman. However, with Dolby Digital Plus, and I know a lot of these, I believe Netflix is going to start doing Dolby Digital Plus, and I'm hoping Apple will through the iTunes, you will be able to, it's almost indistinguishable, even though it's a lossy compression versus the DTS or the Dolby True HD.
Yeah, I mean that I would reiterate that with the about audio. Look at the audio specs of this of the new Apple TV, and it still talks about AEC LC audio rather than supporting, you know, they're not supporting True HD or Master Audio DTS certainly. So I'd be also a little bit. I'd be taking a close eye at that as well. If you want to go to that high end level like I have here, so that's one other thing I look at as the audio formats that are supported by this new Apple TV. Is that I think for me personally, I'm not sure if it's up to what I would want to do. Yep. It doesn't look like that, not today. Maybe some future Apple TV will, but. I think that's where we are for that.
Yeah. You know what's great about... Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, so what we have here is you can have a compromise between convenience and quality.
Yeah.
Because mine is much simpler to set up than what Dean has. And Dean has the quality on both the video side and the audio side. I've chosen not to do that for simplicity's sake, to do my setup. Yeah, I've got a Mac Mini with 4 terabytes connected to it. And 3 Apple TVs. You know, I don't have any of the servers or any of that stuff. And so it's just a little bit easier and a little more approachable for people to deal with.
Well, and what I was going to close with is what's amazing to me is, you know, 5 years ago, we wouldn't even be having a conversation like this about Apple hardware, any of that. You know, so it's unbelievable that now we have a lot of different kinds of technology that we can mix together in a bunch of different ways to achieve what's going to work for us. And so it's great to be able to come and present, you know, everything from what I have. I mean, I'm simpler than both you guys. I have iTunes content and an Apple TV, right? It's just, that's it. And I like that because that's plug and play and I don't even have to do any ripping, encoding, anything like that. And then you have all the way up to something like what you've put together, Dean, which is, you know, going to give you pristine, highest quality that you probably can get out of a system like this.
Well, you know what, though, Adam, I'll be honest with you. Right now, with the fact that you can buy a movie and it's available everywhere, with you know, in the cloud, that's a pretty good setup. And the new 1080p that they're coming out with, it's actually a lot better than what we were talking about a few years ago. So
exactly, that's what I mean.
I think a lot of people are going to be pretty pleased with that setup.
Yeah, I mean, I know that I have. Yet to really buy movies from Apple. I think we talked about this on the last show because I didn't have the ability to re-download them. So I was still buying DVDs because, again, I don't have Blu-ray. I hadn't made that leap yet. But now I am going to have the option to buy the 1080p content from Apple, which for me, going up from Blu-ray is going to be DVD, it's going to be a large jump in quality.
Well, and you know, yeah. Now it becomes pretty clear why Apple didn't get in with ultraviolet, because to test this thing out on my last show live, I said, all right, let me go check out some movies that I bought on my iPhone. I went and I saw, I think I had True Grit. I said download, and then within about 20 seconds of download, I went to the videos application, hit play, and the movie started playing. So now all of a sudden, I've got my content everywhere, and when it's done, you can just delete it from your iPad or your iPhone so you don't have to take up space. And essentially, that's streaming from the cloud, just ultraviolet right there.
Well, and with ultraviolet, if you want to – I don't know if you know this. Have you played with it? If you want to delete the
content from – Yeah, we're not very happy with it.
Delete the content from your iPad, you have to delete the whole app and then reinstall it.
Yeah, so this is – it's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, it's just definitely, you know, the Mac platform, I've been using Apple products since like 1986, about my first Apple IIe way back when. It's just like the flexibility and the reliability you can get out of these Macs. I mean, I'm using, you know, 7-year-old Xers and you know, a whole mix of different hardwares and making them all play together well.
I mean,
that's just like, that's a testament to the Apple platform and you know, all the various forms that it takes, and now the post PC form of it that in the future will take that to a whole nother level.
Yeah, that's one thing that I love about your setup is, you know, you are reusing some old hardware, and it's not ending up in a landfill. And a lot of us, you know, wonder what to do with this stuff. And it's like a lot of this stuff is still useful if you just, you know, find the right application. And this is a great application for it. So, Dean, I want to say thank you for sending the email and agreeing to come on and kind of go through this end of the home theater setup. If people, obviously, I'm going to give them a link to your website, this specific article that you posted, but you know, you also are doing a bunch of other stuff with Mac stuff. You got your company. You want to tell everybody a little bit about how they can check out that and maybe follow you and stuff like that?
Yeah, dadgerresearch.com is the main page, and you can get pretty much everything else. I've got high performance. I do consulting. I sell software, and I do consulting in high performance computing, helping researchers or other people in industry, whether anywhere from aerospace industry to finance and so forth, working like that. So it's like that's the typical kind of clients. But I also have some visualization software, like Atom in a Box is software I have on iPhone and iPad, for that matter. I've been just so busy with the clustering stuff, I haven't been able to port my other stuff to iOS as much as I want to.
Right. Well, I saw you got Pooch. Pooch is running on Lion, right?
Yes, that's right. Got it running on Lion, and we'll evolve forward for Mountain Lion, of course.
Cool.
When that comes out. So that's always exciting stuff.
People should go check that out.
Yeah. But it's just like, you know, but I'm not really I don't think anybody could really hire me for home theater consulting or things like that, because that's just a hobby, and I don't see how I'm going to make money off of that. It's just like I put that page out there because it's like it was from 2006 to 2010, I just like, how do I do 1080p? And I don't see anybody else doing it. And like, I didn't see any documentation. So it's been all kind of like hush hush, like prohibition. Like, how do we do it?
Well, maybe.
And so that's why I wrote that page. So it's like, let's get the information out there. I just want to see the information out there so that other people can like use what they did, because people don't have to do exactly what I did.
Right.
They could like do versions of what I did, or cherry pick ideas. I'm not expecting people to do what I did. I'm just saying that, you know, like, I think this idea needs to sort of get out there that this is how capable the Mac is. It can do these incredible things at the high end and satisfy that.
Well, maybe we'll start a little community here. And Ara, I think you'd be part of that, right?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
So, Ara, thanks for coming on again, once again, and doing home theater stuff with us. Remind everybody where they can see what you're up to and get information on your setup and all that stuff.
Sure. We do a podcast once a week. It's the HT Guys, and we're available at htguys.com. We talk about HGTV, home theater, and, we kind of morphed a little bit beyond that. Sometimes if it's just kind of related to home theater, we talk about it, do home automation, that kind of stuff. So htguys.com. And Adam, it's always a pleasure coming on, talking to fellow Mac fans, because every now and then I get an email, you guys don't do enough about Android. I don't want to say it out loud, but sometimes it's like, do I really have to? So that's why I have a partner on the show, and actually Braden he's my partner. He'll be doing a little bit more on Android.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks, guys. So there you go, the Mac Mini Home Theater. That's 1080p. And what I love about this episode and about this conversation is exactly kind of what Dean was saying there at the end, is that people need to realize that these Macs are really capable. And I sometimes think even Apple doesn't realize how long many of us hold on to our Macs and use them for all kinds of different applications. I was just watching a video this week on still how useful the G4 Macs are, G4 iBooks. Amazing thing. I loved my 14-inch G4 iBook. Unfortunately, it died with a video card issue. But when it was running, it was absolutely fabulous. And those old systems can still be used in a lot of different ways. So when you're thinking about what to do as you're upgrading, you know, think about some of these applications where you might be able to repurpose and reuse one of your Macs. And I think it's just really cool to kind of think about. And it's easy to forget that technology really can last. You just need to be a little bit creative and find the right applications for the technology. And I think we talk about that a lot on the show. You know, it's not always you need the most power. As a matter of fact, this, as I was saying, was content that was from a MacCast member episode. Every week I deliver some extra content to MacCast members, and for that, MacCast members help support the podcast and support what I'm doing. And it's a great relationship. And if you want to check that out, you can get information on it at member.maccast.com. But I talked about recently on an episode, you know, can you replace your iPad, your notebook with an iPad? And are we there yet? Are we really reaching that post-PC era? So I did a whole episode on that. I did an episode on iPad, the iPhoto application for the iPad, that one I just finished. So if you want to get that kind of content, more in-depth kind of how-tos and things like that, you can check out the member program. That's at member.maccast.com. Just a couple bucks a month. You help support the podcast and get some great additional content. So that is going to do it for today. Before I leave you, I do want to take a moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Furonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software, get more information and details over at furonix.com. Circus Ponies, check out Notebook, get a free trial and more information over at circusponies.com. Smile, check out Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label. Also, PDF Pen for the iPad. I told you about that on the last episode. Great application. Still really enjoying it. You can get trials of their Mac applications. More information and details over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, you can get cash for that old cell phone, iPod, iPad. Maybe help subsidize your new iPad purchase. You can get information on that and more details over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for your support. If you have any questions for me, any comments, anything you'd like to follow up on, you can send email to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. Leave voicemail there. And you can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. If you need show notes or links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the MacCast website. That's at maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/MacCast. Or if you can check out the MacCast Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.